Welcome to WRI's Big Ideas into Action podcast. My name is Daniel Baker, Communications Manager here at the World Resources Institute, and the host, editor, and producer of this three-part podcast series called Voices on Supply Chains. In the first episode, we identified the glaring blind spot when it comes to corporate sustainability targets and what those corporations know about the needs of the SMEs, or small businesses, in their supply chain. The power imbalance between buyers and suppliers has created a fragile system that is extremely susceptible to disruptions, which are becoming more common and destructive thanks to climate change. Part of the challenge is that companies tend to focus on their largest suppliers and those closest to them in the supply chain, as Lydia Elliott from the We Mean Business Coalition's SME Climate Hub explains.
If you have this big company with 10,000 suppliers, there's probably going to be a group of suppliers within it that are their high emitters. You know, they'll do their own scope 3 analysis and they'll say, okay, well, if we take this top 20% and that'll be 80% of our emissions, and we're going to start there because that is an easier task, but also it's a task with higher impact. Now, some of those are SMEs in that top 20%. So there are kind of like the higher performing, higher emitting, more strategic to their business SMEs that would definitely be in that group. So they do engage with those ones the same way they might engage with others. They just might give them a bit more help or a bit more, you know, training or support if they needed it.
But the remaining 80% of suppliers may be the ones furthest upstream, with fewer resources to adapt to new sustainability targets or reporting requirements on their own. WRI is, at its core, an environment and climate-based organization. So we would be remiss if we didn't remind you how important SME engagement is when it comes to ensuring a future where people, nature, and climate can all flourish.
The environmental argument for going after the 20% is probably that eventually you have to go after that 20%, number one. Number two, if you look at it on a global scale, SMEs are incredibly important in terms of emissions. So by pushing SMEs to the back of the queue, you don't give them much time to prepare or change. In some ways it helps because technology might be more, you know, mature. They're not kind of testing something. They've been given a solution that's, you know, this solar panel works, you can put it up, it makes sense. But in other ways, they're not getting the same signals that a larger company might be getting. So if, you know, a big supplier has had the last 5 years to prepare for this, a small supplier then is given, you have to do this now, or they're only going to see results in 5 years. But however you approach it, you're not giving the SMEs the same preparation time that you're giving a big supplier in your supply chain.
Remember from episode 1, scope 3 emissions, which for our purposes can be considered supply chain emissions, often account for 70% or more of a corporation's emissions. And as an organization that uses the power of partnerships to create systemic change, it's oh so topical that this episode is all about how corporations can start building partnerships by more equitably distributing the costs throughout their supply chains, something the current just-in-time methods don't support.
I'm Dan Biederman, and I am a partner at a venture capital fund that's trying to support, build equity in supply chains, mostly focused on marginalized workers around the world. The name of our fund is the Working Capital Fund. The paradigm of sourcing is for a buyer, a brand or a retailer, to identify requirements and then RFP it out or engage a bunch of suppliers, and the suppliers will then compete to provide and get the contract. And for the most part, that negotiation happens without reference to sustainability characteristics or conditions whatsoever. And so, yeah, it certainly is rare for a company to create sustainability targets in partnership with their suppliers.
My name is Adil Gitouni. I am an associate professor with the School of Business at the University of Victoria. We actually said that we can outsource this activity that is costing us too much here to another part of the world where they can pay people cheaper to do it. So even from a financial perspective, like having something that is traveling thousands and thousands of miles to be able to be added in the supply chain, and then we assemble and we send to somewhere else and so on, we were able actually to offload the real cost to the society and to the environment.
My name is Charmaine Levy, and I am the project manager of the Ethical Denim Council. If we can just get the brands and the retailers and the importers to do what they say they're going to do, to respect these contracts, to not try to constantly undercut and get discounts and push prices down as far as they can, that then allows the suppliers to do what everybody's expecting them to do.
The absolute fundamental human rights requirement is that the businesses do not exploit the most vulnerable people in their operations and supply chains while they are engaging this business negotiation. And unfortunately, what's been happening over the past several decades is that the most vulnerable people in supply chains have essentially been subsidizing the businesses with their effort and their toil. This is most directly true when we see workers crossing borders for jobs and carrying debt with them that they've paid essentially to get the jobs overseas. But it's also true when a worker works unpaid overtime or has to work on weekends rather than taking care of their kids to sort of meet the needs of their employer. It's indisputable that you can create product in unsustainable ways. You just can't do it for a long period of time and hope to develop business sectors and societies in the way that we all want.
We just heard about some of the human toll of our just-in-time supply chain methods. Jason Judd and his team at Cornell University's Global Labor Institute just published a report in 2023 that details the environmental impacts of such a system.
On the flooding side, we looked at Bangladesh. We could plot on a map the position of factories, and then we could project the flood levels around those factories in 2030 from sea level rise and from rainfall or riverine flooding. And we saw in 2030, under what we call a 100-year flood or an RP100, fully 27% of the existing apparel factories in 2030 would be inundated at a half meter or more. And a half meter doesn't put you out of business, but it does stop production. It could stop it for a day. It could stop it for a week or two or three. It depends on the factory. You don't have to wait 100 years between floods. They're becoming more common, right?
The dangers of flooding and heat aren't theoretical. They're here, and the effects are very, very real.
Here's an example of the impact or the scale of extreme heat in Pakistan, in Karachi. There's lots of apparel production. In 2030, the analysis shows that 190 out of 365 days in the year, the combination of heat and humidity, it's called the wet bulb globe temperature, will exceed 31 Celsius, this threshold at which productivity really starts to fall off. That's a big number. We ran 29 other centers in places like Colombo in Sri Lanka, or Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam also had a high number of high heat days. And we saw that those numbers would jump quickly between 2025 and 2030, and then jump again between 2030 and 2050. So it's hot already in these places, even for workers who are accustomed to the heat, and it's going to get hotter fast.
Now, some corporations might invest in the bare minimum infrastructure for their SMEs, because it benefits their bottom line.
High heat means less output, and less output means, you know, lower earnings, lower margins.
But a partnership means a lot more than adding some AC units to an unbearably hot factory. When we asked the experts about partnerships between corporations and SMEs, we got a lot of different answers of what that looks like.
I'm Taj Aldridge. I am the Managing Director for Climate Innovations at GFF Labs. Sometimes people just assume a partnership has to be 50-50. I don't think so. I think a partnership is about benefit, and if both groups find their own individual benefit in that relationship. And so, again, putting the economic hat on, it's about incentives. So I think if incentives are aligned and incentives are different for each part of that partnership, then it may make sense.
What the group did agree on is that partnerships do not look like corporations literally moving their operations to other parts of the world.
My name is Jacques Leslie, Los Angeles Times contributing opinion writer. I write frequently for Yale Environment 360. Companies have tried, or I should say, are beginning to try to think about this by wondering if they can move a lot of their supply chain to closer where the manufacturing process is taking place, or in some cases, they're talking about creating dual supply chain, so that if one is blocked, they can turn to another. But these things are very expensive, It's not easy to do, and in particularly when companies are relying on, say, a whole constellation of parts manufacturers in a place like China or Vietnam, it's not easy to move away from them.
The industry left to its own devices, the apparel industry, will never agree on a set of rules, and it won't enforce them on itself. This model of self-regulation, private regulation, you know, it's very 2005. It's very pre-climate crisis. So the way to get over this collective action problem is to have a set of rules that say, here's the standard, and firms that don't meet the standard will face a sanction. New rules being written in the European Union mean that these lead firms like H&M, Nike, Costco, et cetera, even if they're American firms, if they're doing a significant amount of business in Europe, they're going to fall under the European rule that requires those lead firms to not just know where their stuff is coming from beyond tier one, but also to know under what conditions it was made. It's called the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive. And it means that lead firms are going to be, in one way or another, on the hook now for what happens to workers, what happens to the environment along their supply chains. That's new.
And oh, by the way, if you don't have credible and authenticated lineage or chain of custody with that data and what they're doing and their supplier is doing, you're going to be caught on the carpet and you're going to be fined and you're going to be held accountable. And it, in the age of social media and digital, I mean, it takes one post. You know, child labor, forced labor, casual labor, those things happen all the time. But I think now it becomes viral. Hi, my name's Sherry Heinisch. I currently work at EY as their global sustainable supply chain leader. And I also have a podcast, The Supply Chain Revolution. By and large, I do like the accountability culture, you know, where you can no longer just make these commitments and not be held to some sort of standard of being a responsible and ethical steward, corporate steward. So that's what's changing, and that is going to force collaboration, even with smaller suppliers, because you can't just stop at tier one anymore.
Stronger protections for workers in the U.S., for example, could have ripple effects throughout the supply chain.
My name is Becca Coughlin, and I am the Senior Advocacy Manager at Remake, fighting for fair pay and climate justice in the fashion industry. In this country, unions are having a moment again. Workers are sort of gaining power again in a way that they haven't had for a very long time. So that's super crucial. And I think even that happening in the global north has huge ramifications for what happens in the global south.
That being said, we're trying to highlight the importance of partnerships directly between buyers and suppliers, aka the private sector. And next, you'll hear from Vicky Sins at the World Benchmarking Alliance. Vicky leads the work examining the credibility of decarbonization and energy transition plans for some of the world's biggest companies in the highest emitting sectors.
On the adaptation side, there's a huge exposure currently, which is already being looked at, but it's missing the private sector lens. So currently, adaptation is very much considered a public good or a public affairs almost. Just like we do on the social elements, we automatically look at governments or public finance to fill that gap. But then we also have, you know, the loss and damage discussion. If you just look at the outcome of all the commitments, the financial commitments that have come out of COP28, if you would add those up, public finance is a fraction of what that amount of money is that would be needed in order to facilitate that. So we need to be very strong at articulating what is the role of the private sector and private finance, because if we don't, and then we go back to your earlier question on who's shouldering the majority of the risk, the bill will end up, not the financial bill, but the bill that they feel it impacted on the lives of the people, it will end up with the ones that are currently already not able to either be heard, have their voice represented, or be able to absorb these risks from a financial perspective or from a general social well-being perspective. So I think it is very difficult to voice one risk, but I think currently the additionality of all the risks that have come to fruition where we are now due to the inaction we've seen over the last decades is the biggest risk on the most vulnerable that we have in our supply chains.
And now that we've put the onus squarely back on the corporations, this is a perfect time to add another word to our proposed solution, procurement.
I think the strong procurement policy is a very important one, right? There in that procurement policy, you can be very explicit about what you expect from your suppliers.
Partnerships are founded on two T's, transparency and trust.
So much of the time in the global north, we think that we know better and we know what other people need or should be doing. But workers are living this day to day. They know exactly what they need and, have different perspectives and might be able to shed light and provide solutions on different things that, we aren't even thinking about sitting here in our cushy lives. Actually ask workers and workers' representatives what they want and need.
Often we get the remark from companies to say, yeah, but this is such a big issue. This is not for us to solve. And we're like, yeah, but back to that trust point, we do expect these companies to be very transparent. They are the one to know what is their strategy in terms of fulfilling their climate targets. So they are the ones that also need to be very transparent about what the impact is. If you want to move away from a certain region because you're no longer using, coal that comes from a specific region, you need to plan for that. We don't require you to do that tomorrow, but we know that in 10, 15 years' time, we expect the reliance of that to be reduced. So that means that you need to start planning with governments, with finance to really transition these jobs to new green and decent jobs in the future.
And the best way to establish that trust and transparency? Fair contracts. Professor Guattoni, Becca Coughlin, and Sherry Heinisch explain why fair contracts are the foundation for partnerships.
Contracts that are based on incentives, they create better surplus and build actually better trust compared to contracts that are based on penalties. So this is what is the evidence. But unfortunately, most of the people that are hired in these companies, they look at this from transactional perspective, from how much we're making on this kind of deal and so on. And because of the governance of corporations, we don't actually accept to consider multi-year kind of now performance metrics, because in order to be able to value the collaboration and trust, you need to consider a long-term time horizon to be able to evaluate that. You need, with the relational model, which is actually collaboration, trust, and so on, you need actually to build this kind of now evaluation over a bigger time horizon, 5 years, 10 years, whatever. And that's what happened in most companies, that they were able to transition seriously toward more sustainable behavior.
In terms of fairer contracts, we need brands to actually not just use the word partner, but actually to partner with their suppliers instead of dictating self-serving contract terms to them. Enter into a contractual relationship with your suppliers that it's based on mutual input, mutual agreement, and in which you are equally liable for not upholding your end of the deal as they are for not upholding theirs.
We have to think about the total economic impact and the value creation lens of everything that we do, because we cannot leave people behind. We already have climate migration. We already have people who aren't able to meet basic needs. And that also affects our supply chains. It affects the communities where we operate. We saw with COVID, for example, like if you're a business and you've been in this environment where it's lowest cost, highest profit, if you're the society that's supporting your manufacturing plant isn't healthy and able to meet basic needs, you will fail.
We're still not at the stage where influential corporations are legally obligated to make binding sustainability commitments to their suppliers or the surrounding communities.
People use this word, like they use supply chain, the word partner. And I think that that word needs to be deleted from this discussion. I'm Andrew Ola. I'm the founder of the Ethical Denim Council. The word partner implies a share of a win. Well, the brand's win might be 55 or 60% of their selling price. For a retailer, it might be 70 to 80% of their selling price. And to a garment factor, it might be the only win that they get is that they cover their cost. The worker, for instance, in Bangladesh, make $72 a month, and the people buying make much more, and the company makes billions. So I think that the word partnership sounds great, but I'm not sure it's really the right word to use in business. Most suppliers that I know just want to be a vendor and be paid. They're not looking for partnerships.
We didn't find lead firms, apparel brands, that have focused on adaptation and have made plans, either top-down plans, here's what suppliers must do, or are consulting suppliers on adaptation measures. For sure, there's a little bit of it happening out there, but we spoke with lots of brands and lots of suppliers, as well as workers for this paper, and very, very, very few of them, brands and suppliers, had figured out what their approach was going to be. These factory-level problems are deemed external to the firm's balance sheet.
Even when sustainability targets are set, achieving those goals is still usually confined to a specific department, separate from the rest of the company.
My name is Namit Agarwal. I work as the social transformation lead at the World Benchmarking Alliance. You know, very few companies are actually engaging with rights holders in the due diligence process. And this is where I think the trust deficit kind of becomes quite dominant. So if that opportunity for rights holders and workers to participate in risk identification, in due diligence, in helping companies set out what are the actions that they need to take, that is a big gap when the rights holders are not part of those processes. So that I think is quite critical, both in terms of the steps that companies have taken, but what are some of the significant gaps that exist in these two sectors?
It is still very much treated as two separate elements. And the social element, like Namit often sees, is we engage with different stakeholders within the company when we talk about human rights, when we talk about social impact, then when we talk with the climate team, right? Those are often still two separate teams in different geographies, different parts of the company. And they not often see that both of their strategies have to go hand in hand because they need to be translated into addressing two sides of the same coin, the way we say it, because you can't have a successful decarbonization with stranded communities and stranded people, and you can't do it the other way around as well.
It's clear that partnerships are not a panacea, but still offer lots of promise, so long as they are mutually beneficial to both large companies and SMEs and their supply chain. Don't miss the next episode as we wrap up our series by sharing examples of partnerships between corporations and SMEs. Thank you to all of our guests who lent their expertise and insights for this edition of Voices on Supply Chains. The story continues at wri.org/crest. For all of us at WRI, my name is Daniel Baker, host and producer for the series. The series is part of a project funded by the Ares Charitable Foundation as part of their CREST initiative, a 5-year career preparation and reskilling initiative that aims to close the gap between the demand for a skilled workforce for green jobs and the number of people prepared for these opportunities to build an equitable, low-carbon economy. Don't forget to leave a 5-star rating on whatever podcast streaming service you heard this episode on. Every review counts. Thanks for listening.